thing.
Based on this, I could have assigned, in this class, if we were doing an introduction to literary theory, I could assign you this collection of essays on 9 or 10 different critical approaches, right? So here we have Victor Schlafsky's Art as Technique, all kinds of, some Freud essays, Marx essays, Althusser, Lukács, feminism essays, the Laura Mulvey. I mean, this is a pretty good anthology, all right? But what I was doing in this course is more just going back to primary texts, and there's kind of a reason for that. I mean, you kind of need to know this stuff, sort of. All right. And in fact, we've scheduled a comparative literature seminar for next fall. Jerry Friedman's going to do, she's supposed to do, a kind of survey of critical theories. Right. So if you want more theory than I'm giving you, we're setting that up for next year. Right. Yeah.
Is it different from the one that we used
to have? A lot of it's the same. It's just another
version.
I mean, theory, we all bought thousands of theory books, and they just, mine just sit there. I never look at them again. Okay. There are a few,
you get it.
Yeah, there's a few things. The problem is, like what Song was doing today, to me, is absolutely fascinating. It's really the way you read literature, especially if you want to go around the world. And I'm kind of defining, to me, comparative literature is getting more and more to mean world literature. And we're trying to grapple with some of the problems of getting anybody to have any kind of understanding outside, beyond just everything coming in translations. That's the point of the first lines exercise, and I'm still thinking about it, all right? But if I wrote a brilliant book on that, that would be why I would do that. Nonetheless, 95-99% of your dissertations can't be written on that kind of stuff. You can't just read something and do a really fun analysis. Here's what the Chinese means, here's what's left out. It's not theoretically sophisticated enough, right? It's not what you can get published in, right? So what I'm talking about today is really what you can get published in, what you will probably be doing, right? So you'll pick some critical approach, and I'm just suggesting it is really an academic exercise, and you should know that going in because it helps you keep perspective on it, right? To know what you're getting into. I'm going to use this as a segue into that Elder Olson article. Let me get this. Let me just make sure it's here before I get this thing all set up. All right. Where is it? I'm trying to find PowerPoint.
Standard software.
Oh yeah, Microsoft Office. So here we are. Is this if I
change the input?
What?
Probably
have
to change the input.
Ah, should be sound. There it is. It's nothing there. Oh boy. Every one of these is different.
Really?
Yeah, really. And sometimes they switch them in the same room. This is like a new one, even in this room. Give me a break.
could just stand around the computer.
No.
It would work.
There it is. All right, so that's the book I was just holding up. All right. So, I mean, if I had that, the Vince Leach book I ordered for this that we haven't been using is a kind of history of criticism, right? And he had to go, Norton made him go back to the beginning, but his heart was really in only modern critical approaches, really 20th century approaches. So, if you had that two books, this one just struck me as pretty good too, right? And you get all the readings in this volume, and then you get this guy discussing each of his 12 critical approaches here and applying them each to King Lear. And none of us know all 12 approaches that well, but I'm just going to sort of run through them because I'm doing this before the Elder Olson essay, because Olson's essay is what we call a formalist approach to literature. But it's formalist, really not even in the sense that Ryan would use formalism, but the school of formalism that came out of what were called the University of Chicago Aristotelians. They were reading Aristotle's Poetics really hard in the 30s and 40s and 50s. And that's where Olson's coming from. And that's really all I'll talk about when we go back there. He's always got that Poetics, which is what Jason did earlier in the seminar. We went through those six parts of a tragedy: plot, character, thought, diction, and music, and spectacle. And that's what's in the back of Olson's mind. And he uses that notion of form to attack Ibsen, whose definition of poetry is only refers to language and not to the poem as a shaped form or a thing. The Chicagoans always like to compare a poem to a house. Okay? But Ibsen, whatever he's doing, is not doing that, right? What's so interesting, I'm trying to... Olson also defined the new criticism, right? And I thought that's important in any history. The new criticism is what people did with poetry in the classroom in the 40s and 50s and 60s, all right? The kind of exercise you could assign to a class. You give them a poem and you ask them what it means, and they talk about the irony and the tension and the paradox and stuff like that. And it was never that big, to my mind, wasn't that big a movement, but it worked well in a lot of little schools. The kind of places where Vince Leach, the editor, I'll badmouth him, he's a smart guy, but where Vince came from, right? And then people were taught this sort of very constricted view of poetry. And a lot of guys rebelled against that. And that, to my mind, it's because they went to lousy schools, okay? And they weren't allowed to talk about big things like the author's life. You know, the new critics couldn't care less about the author's life. They didn't look at the cultural context. They had no sense of history. They didn't read philosophy. You know, they didn't have an education. They just went and, you know, majored in English and did these little narrow, constricting views of poems. So the reaction against that was theory. Theory was what let people do something else, right? Bring in Freud, bring in women's studies, bring in all kinds of other approaches, right? And they sort of got, there was a sense in the last 30 years that it was all new, right? But what's really interesting, if you go back to the new critics, hardly any of it was new. And there had been Marxist approaches to literature back in the 20s and 30s. Then they got swept away by the new critics, and then they all came back again.
They just didn't have terms for it.
Well, it was really the same stuff, okay? But, you know, so these movements go back and forth. And nonetheless, the problem's the same. And Olson is talking about how you talk about poetry as a form, but if you read the essay, you were disappointed by the end of it. I think it's very brilliant, but by the end it doesn't go anywhere. You can't write a dissertation on this stuff. I think it's a really good way to read, and it's a good way to teach. So I do my Shakespeare classes like this, all right? Because it's very honest, and it deals with poetry as poetry, all right? for the Chicago school, the problem was all other critical approaches were not about poetry per se. If you come in and do a Freudian analysis, you better understand Freud. So you're really not talking about the literature, you're talking about Freud's ideas, and you really belong in the psychology department, but they won't let you in. Because they've got all other methods. You know, they want you to set up a classroom and do statistical analysis and stuff like that. All right? Well, women's studies be another example, okay? If you know, you can do an analysis of women's issues in literature, and it's very productive, it's a lot of fun, and that's, half of you will write your dissertations on that, but you should also realize the limitations of it, okay? That you're not necessarily talking about the literature as literature, and you're always opening up yourself to the problem of, that you're really kind of talking anthropology, and your concepts of social customs and stuff like that are coming from another field, anthropology or sociology, that's not literature per se. So in literature departments, we always have this schizophrenia. We go out and find a theory in some other field and then apply it to literature. Even Freud does that. He thinks up, I will do Freudianism. Let me go read Oedipus Rex now. Okay, or Hamlet. I see Hamlet talking to his mother. Whoa. Okay? You get it? I mean, and it's good, and a lot of people, do that, but you have to, I'm just setting this up, all right? So it's a context. We're all stuck doing that. And I don't have any objections to it, because it's a lot of fun, all right? But you got to realize you're having fun, and they're not going to let you in the sociology department. And I think if you just keep a perspective on this stuff, it helps. So let's take a look. Let's see what I have. All right, so here are the critical approaches that he talks about. Formalism, again, this will be sort of the Russian formalists, not necessarily the Chicago formalists, but hardly worth making the distinction. But you've heard of these other terms, right? Structuralism, psychoanalysis. And, could you... Here's in 1999, this is where you got, all right? In 2006, what would you add? Anybody know what the hot fields...
Phenomenology?
Nah, that's from the 50s.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, queer theory, I guess. Well, that might go into gender studies here, but now you could probably... You could bring queer theory out of the closet and give it its own rubric. What?
Complementarity.
What's that? Is that from Floyd Merrill?
Quantum mechanics.
Yeah, historicism, new historicism. Quantum mechanics? Catherine Hales does all this chaos theory, right?
Deconstruction.
Yeah, right. Doesn't really have deconstruction here, does he?
Post-structuralism.
Yeah, I suppose that fits in.
Post-structuralism.
Okay.
But it's
kind of
historicism.
Is kind of the answer, anyway. So I don't want to keep you here all night. Disability studies.
Oh.
Very big. Okay. We have two dissertations going on it right now. But again, you got to realize they're not like reading hundreds of novels to come up with a theory of disability studies. They go and read a thing on disability studies and then bring it into, selected four novels here and five novels there. And, this sort of bothers me because it makes it hard for you to walk into a world literature class in the kind of small schools where a lot of us or you will teach, and also do Homer and Milton and some Shakespeare, right? I suppose you could do disability studies approach to Shakespeare, but the class will get a little ticked off with you, believe me. Right? So the formalist approach, what I try and push with the actions and stuff, kind of works everywhere. Well, let's take a look. What is formalism? Oh, I got it all. There's those key terms from...
You said this is on the internet?
I lost it. I'll put it back up there. Okay, we'll go through this fast. But it's all in the book, and this is just a summary. Okay, so if you can do a dissertation on paradox as a structuring principle or something like that. All right. Now, Elder Olson's very interesting on that because, paradox and irony are what's called tropes. Okay. Turns of language. When you take the literal sense and you make it mean something else, kind of like metaphors. And there's, you know, there are lists of these that come down to us from the ancient Greeks, and which we have in Puttenham, say, in the English Renaissance. But as Olson said, you could double the list. For any of these tropes, you could have infinite variations if you felt like it. And in fact, that a lot of deconstructionist criticism was just taking a trope like paradox or irony and playing with it to death. Okay? And then when I did a course on rhetoric years ago, I just gave everybody a trope. You get zeugma, you get metaphor, you got irony. Go write a paper on it and just play with it like crazy, and you start to sound like Derrida real fast. Who was actually a close reader of Plato. I'm not trying to knock him. Okay, but you know, he spent his life reading those dialogues, and then somebody actually got interested in what he was saying, so he came up with a head full of Greek philosophy. All right, well, anyway, I don't know if you know King Lear, but I think the examples would be typical. This is almost like a Marxist contradiction. Paradox or irony? Cordelia, the favorite daughter, she's the favorite, but yet she's an outcast. Whoa, let's talk about that. Okay, you can see an undergraduate writing a paper on that and saying, defining this stuff. Okay, what are the values in the that are being expressed in the story? This stuff is very powerful approach to literature. Okay, because it seems to me very close to. What language and human activity is about. But anyway, truth is prized. Cordelia tells her father he's just an old man. And he knows he's just an old man, but he demands that she say how much she loves him. Okay? So we get this contradiction there. People reverse places. This is a typical movement in the novel where somebody got, you can come from poverty to great wealth. Horatio Alger story, okay? You can be, I'm sure James Ellroy for next week will fit into this pattern, the hero. The hero is what? He's a boxer and a brute, but he's a sensitive inside, okay? She's a prostitute with a heart of gold, right? The standard cliche, all right? Here in this case, the king becomes a beggar, so, right? And then the beggar, Edgar, will be king. We'll get to more of this later. This is straight out of Oedipus. Okay? As soon as you see the truth, the eyes have to go. Right? So the literary form is set up paradoxically. This is what, by the way, Woody Allen's best movie, what is it called?
It's Hollywood Ending.
No, the one where the eye surgeon's having an affair. Yeah, well, I mean, you know, he's actually got an eye surgeon as the guy who's having an affair. You see, he's blind, right? So it's called Truth and... it's got a kind of Dostoevskian title, I can't remember.
There's Love and Death.
Yeah, something like that, that's more Bergman. Anyway, never mind, you get the idea, right? This shows up in Oedipus. In King Lear, the secondary character, Gloucester, favors his bastard son, who's a real bastard, and cheating him, and rejects his good son. And the minute he realizes that his good son was actually good, he's been blinded. He gets blinded, and then he learns the truth. Right? So, that's just, you know, literature seems to like that stuff. Is that the nature of literature? And that Olson wouldn't say so. That's not exactly a plot, is it? It's not a sequence of human activities, not a sequence of decisions and actions taken with some sort of moral resonance, but it's something that you tend to find in these works. Well, how about what's structuralism? This is what we were talking about in Jameson. Okay? You don't look at these people as people, but as actants. Okay? This guy, he's not a hermit in the woods, he's a donor who's going to help the hero move down the path. All right? So this kind of analysis is structuralism. How does that fit King Lear? In other words, Cordelia is not a little girl who has trouble talking to daddy. She's a plot function. Okay? She's the one sort of to make trouble or to root out the bad people and restore truth somehow. Right? So she's almost like a magic figure, which actually explains her pretty well, because otherwise she's one weird girl as a person. Right? So it's got some possibilities to it. What else do we have? Characters are signifiers. Again, the characters are not people in this sense. If we looked at the story Tsang did today, I thought that was such a nice analysis, because we got a real sense of a very complicated old man with all his vanities and his illusions, right? It's almost psychological. And you might say, well, you belong in the psychology department, or the study of emotions like that is almost rhetoric, it's not poetry. But anyway, here the characters are signifiers, not necessarily characters, and they represent concepts. So a good character represents trust, and when he's betrayed, it's the betrayal of trust. Okay, and you want to be very careful. Writing like this is how to write a bad novel, I got to tell you that. But analysis of this is good. Okay, if you start writing what Olson calls didactic fiction, you got to Verica and you got a problem with the story, or you have some Russian novel about the good machinist working on the dam for the benefit of the Soviet state, right? You know? And right, so, and there's more than a little of that in, say, Tolstoy. Even in War and Peace, the hero is a guy named Peter, who's a wonderful character because he's big and lumbering and he makes all kinds of mistakes, but somehow he gets through and gets the girl and lives happily. But he's an image of Russia herself, Russia itself, a big, lumbering, but kind of good-hearted guy. So, you know, even a most realistic novelist like Tolstoy will be tending to attach values, and structuralism's looking to pull them out, right? Ooh, that looks complicated. Well, again, this is what Jameson was doing when the good and bad, the moral qualities of good and bad, okay, become like linguistic terms, and it's the opposition that counts, not the goodness or badness, okay? Because if you follow Nietzsche, that we have no consent, we have no absolute good and evil. It's only as things relate to other things. Now you can argue against that. I think there's a strong argument against it, but most people will write their dissertations not on, I think I know the truth. God told it to me. That won't get you very far in your dissertation. You have to write about this instead, right? Oh. So that's the way it goes. But you get to read a lot of good books. All right. I want to talk about that. You'd have to read that. This took me a long time to figure. I actually summarized this before I understood it, so it's not immediately intuitive. These are the good characters who are duped by others, so they're innocents, right? But in a structural terms, there are people who know and people who don't know. That's what's going on. And it's usually the bad characters who manipulate in the tragedies, and they're in the know. Right, and so that you set up a binary that
there's
way.
There's no judgment. There's no like personal judgment.
Go ahead.
It's an innocent kind of. There's a judgment there. There's a
right.
positive quality of
right.
being innocent.
Right. Yeah, because you could just as easily say they're foolish, right? But and they're probably meant to be. Okay, so we take out the values of innocence or traitors, and people who don't know and people who do know. It's another dichotomy, right? One that generally sets up dramatic irony when we know more than the characters and we're in a certain position, which is the exact irony you were talking about at the end of this story. We know the old man is rather foolish, but he certainly doesn't know. He thinks he's a victim, okay? And he thinks he's good and in the right. I've always had a lot of trouble understanding structuralism in the 30 years, even when people were talking about it. And they just there was a classic book, a series of essays on structuralism that came out in 1968, and it's just been re-released, actually 66. with great fanfare, and I remember reading it, and it still meant nothing to me. I mean, I think you had to be in a particular seminar room getting the full Levi Strauss moment out of this. But this Ryan book's pretty good. The play's about the need to maintain a royal noble king. Lear's getting old. How do you replace him with another good character, right? And so it's a series of tests, you know, to see who's really fit to be king. Okay, it's in a society where normally you'd expect the king's son to come in. Lear has no son, so that means a value judgment comes into play as who should be king. Really, so in a society that doesn't really ask, "Do you deserve to be king?" the play asks, "Hey, how about we look at whether someone's actually qualified to be king instead of just being born to it?" And that seems to be what he's arguing. That's what the play is about. I'm not sure it is, but well, this is kind of long. Yeah, here it is: nobility trumps natural succession. That's the argument he makes, and that he considers that a structural argument. And I'm no expert on it, but so let's. Oh my God, there's more of this? I'll be here all night. Let's get on to another one. Okay, psychoanalysis. It's the study of sexual fears and desires, often unconscious. Huge literature on this. All right? Have fun. I mean, everybody should write a psychoanalytic paper, you know, at some point, because they're kind of fun to do. And here we go. The real thing is this notion of the creation of the self. Thousands of people write about the self. They all passed me by. I have no idea what that means. What is the self?
That Greenblatt's self-fashion.
Yeah, right. You know, self is it's always some kind of metaphor. I mean, even Greenblatt said, well, there's the theory of the self as an onion, where you peel away the layers. There's a series of theories of self, this like Freud, where it's sort of like you go underwater and you go into the subconscious, and there's this little nugget of self once you get underneath all the surface repressions. Then in the Renaissance, there's a notion of self as the mask I put on, just like an actor. There's no concept. My inner self means nothing. If my exterior is everything, can I fool you? And I might even start to believe the mask I put on, like a clown or a courtier or a king. I will put on my crown, I will become a king. It's from the outside in, rather than the Freud inside out. But people like this stuff, and they're feeling useless. And it's very powerful. Okay, now, you could do whole courses on this. All right. That's too related to, let's go to Marxism. Yeah, well, you get the idea. You go get see it on. All right. I think this is what kind of values are projected as good in a given society, in a given economic system, right? In a feudal system, manly strength is big, right? Because you have to rule everybody and beat up the people who are not in line and are not beat. Not in their role as servants, including women and peasants, right? Today, it's very different, right? You go through school in America today, it's all the group, right? You have to get along in a group. The individual is not the big thing. The reading a text in isolation and reading lots of books, what used to be the value of an English PhD. Which one of you is really going to go to that library and work the hardest? And there's still a bit of that in some of our expectations here. It's more than a bit in my expectations. But I know I'm a kind of dinosaur that way. You go into the red comp thing, well, let's sit eight people in a room. How well can we work together? Okay. What strategy of unity can we come up with, right? Whereas, even 50 years ago, that was anathema to an artist. The artist was the individual working in isolation, getting away from everybody else, getting away from society. So the Marxist values changed, and this is a way of tracing that. All right, so I won't go on to that. So what's post-structuralism? Well, basically the answer is instead of these oppositions. Everything is language in post-structuralism. That's why Jameson had to start with language in his essay and come back to it. They were just hung up with language. And I think the main reason is people really... I think they actually confuse... Confuse culture with language, as if language was the determining cultural vehicle. In other words, if you start using pronouns wrong, like he and she, you will be invariably sexist.
Right.
You'll never get it straight. Even though in English, I hate to tell you, the word his always meant both genders, and it actually meant the neuters too. There was no word its until 1600. Okay, his was the word for it, or its, the possessive pronoun. And his in all texts always meant everybody. Right? But in all legal texts, really, up until almost 3 years ago. Right? But now it's all turned and we start using plurals because somehow, you know, people got this notion that language is terrible for it. But there's another view of culture. What is a culture? Yeah, I mean, I had no idea, but I was reading one of Lewis's other books, and he said, a culture is what you're surrounded by. I think that's the easiest language. And we don't have cultural studies on this list, so I'll talk about it here just real quick. What's a culture? Well, what are we surrounded by? Well, basically, you could have cars, right? We are in an automobile culture. You can't get away from it, right? China is now an automobile culture. Right, everybody. No, not yet. Well, okay, so it's getting there. The world is an automobile culture. It's the thing that's all around you. In art, we're not in a book culture anymore. We're in a film culture. It just, you know, it's just use the word culture value free. It's just what are you stuck with? I was thinking about that. You think of Islam, okay? They're in a religious culture. It's value free. It's just everywhere.
What do you mean when you say value?
I mean, they don't ask whether it's good or bad. It's just there. There's people praying over here. There's mosques there. Everybody's saying, you know, and in America, we are in a, you know, kind of Christian culture because it's everywhere. It's all around. You can't get away from it. Even if you're not going to church or anything, it's just in the air.
Especially this time of year.
Right. Although it's, you know, it's thinning out. Right. So religion, it's just like books or cars or trains or horses, you know, if you were in a horse culture. So I'm not sure language is everything. I think, but certainly for post-structuralists it was. It was the determining thing that changed the way you thought. Okay, I think the average kid doesn't think that. It doesn't even, I don't know.
So post-structuralism is kind of,
go ahead.
I think what
I have to read this.
Confuse me and the rest of the
time. I'm confusing everybody. I mean, I don't expect you to remember this. I'm just making the point that there are lots of approaches, okay, and you invariably pick the one that kind of interests you, and then you know try and have a little knowledge of the other fields in case you get asked at some point.
Full understanding of post-structuralism.
Well, let's take a look. The notion, there's no such thing as aesthetic beauty, there's no such thing as justice, it's all power. Okay? That's certainly the way.
Nietzsche's point of view?
No, but that's the way the post-structuralists think. That it's certainly Greenblatt's Renaissance self-fashioning, the whole thing is power. That's why he focuses on the court. You want to look at the England, you look at Queen Elizabeth. You want to understand Shakespeare, you realize that he is mimicking attitudes and rituals that go on at the court where the royal people, either Queen Elizabeth or King James, have to set up certain ways of doing things to maintain their power. Otherwise, everybody would realize that they're just the emperor with no clothes.
I wish they hadn't called it post-structuralism, though.
Yeah, right. That's the hard part.
Because it doesn't say
it's a huge term.
Like, how is that a reaction to structuralism?
Well, that's why I do this. What they mean when they say that.
Right.
And when they write, they just write post-structuralist, and you never know what they mean.
It's awful.
But what they mean is this.
Okay.
So I'm giving you the one word explanation tonight.
Great.
Right? We could have dragged this out all semester, but I thought a half an hour. Because I'm not. But it, you know, you can get into some of this in depth. And again, this is the stuff. And you, when you start reading the criticism that you're going to be using to write, first of all, it gets interesting. But
isn't their focus always a big part too on like language's inability to express things? Like,
that sounds like deconstruction.
Yeah, which would be part of structuralism.
Right.
Yeah.
Deconstruction is part of post-structuralism.
Well, the inability to express it, but it does express things, but it's hiding the real power relationships. Okay. That's not. That's what's not being expressed.
Deconstruction is basically like everything is meaningless, right? Isn't that basically, or like, I mean, it's kind of that. Like, what is
everybody's got a different one. I think for this class, in the Jameson essay, when he says deconstruction is the lining up of binaries, which automatically start to have value judgments, good, bad, black, white, big, tall, and to realize that. To say that there aren't those value judgments aren't there, that they're the result of what they call the Western logos experience, right? But you could imagine another society where these values would be reversed, or you can break them apart. And your task is to go in as a cultural critic and show where these things are just expressing power. You say the tall guy is good and the short guy is bad. A. Don't you realize that expresses male values, okay? Because men are bigger than women, you know. And for some people, it's like, hey, duh. But for others, that's cool. They want to write 300 pages about it. I don't know, you know, it's all your attitude. That's why I mean. I think the expression of this stuff is perennially fascinating in the art. Here's deconstruction. Well, so what's he say? Okay, so Western philosophy claims to speak for truth and reason, but is actually speaking for other power relationships, like men or Western society itself versus the Orient, to use Said's term, okay? And that's what, and you have to get at that prejudice, you deconstruct, okay? So good terms, speech, men, originality, truth, white, us, bad terms, writing, women, repetition, representation. Okay? And this stuff is very, very powerful. All right? Well, crisis of madness is a crisis of metaphysics. Well, that sounds like Jameson. We have a world of... Yeah, I don't think we can go over this because we haven't been doing. Let's skip the example now. Let's just go on to feminism. I mean, these are, you know, you can do this with any. Now, something like this, this is, becomes the standard essay question on a prelim or an MA exam here. Okay, because I can fit almost any book in there. I feel comfortable to say, well, discuss the marginalization of women in the Bacchae and Julius Caesar, which you were just asking me about. And you go,
what?
The women get drunk and Portia eats fire. In both cases, the women... you know, get madness projected on him. Starts to be, you know, suddenly I'm thinking, Ophelia goes mad, Lady Macbeth goes mad, all the women are going mad in Shakespeare. They must be fairly powerless, okay? So we're all in the post-structural thing where madness is a form of, or an expression of powerlessness, right? And this has been the overwhelming idea for the last, really, 25 years, all right? Yeah, yeah. You know, but again, I, you know, once you get there, and your job is to go to the next thing, okay? So they'd sort of been there, done that, but it's still interesting, and there's still places to work. Okay, gender studies—that's the queer theory. But this is still kind of perennially fascinating question. A lot of analyses of modern plays, like Who's Afraid? Do you ever watch Sex and the City? Do you know it, you guys? Well, you know, it's about four women, right? But it's written by gay guys, and it's clearly about four gay men, because the women have so much sex. No women have sex that much, right? Okay, so you know, and talk about it like that, so you really know it's actually about the problems of being a gay man in New York, right? And that's the standard analysis of that play. And even something like Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf by Edward Albee, who's a gay man, okay? The bitchy conflict between George and Martha, you know, may be played by Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton, but we know it's two guys. Okay, really. I don't know how this is going to play out in the Elroy next week. Okay, you guys don't. But just in case you're thinking you're not reading it, okay. Remember, maybe you got the two boxers, and then who's the actress who played the girlfriend, Kay? Kay Lake. Scarlett Johansson, and one of the boxers is sort of living with her but not having sex with her, and the other one wants to have sex with her, but he just hangs out for 3 years in their living room. You tell me that's not, you know, I don't know if it is or not, but, you know, take a look. Right? It sort of looks weird, right? Looks like that there's a gender, maybe a gender thing going on, but maybe not. But that's the kind of, this can get out of hand real fast, so, like, I think I just got out of hand with the Elroy, okay? I mean, I don't think there's any notion in the play that King Lear at the age of 80 has an interest in the Duke of Albany. it ain't there, I guarantee you. But boy, there's plenty of essays on it. And there are people with named chairs at major universities who write this stuff.
People look at Merchant of Venice as a big one.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, there's a much better example in Measure for Measure, but you don't have to get into that. Well, anyway, I don't know. I don't write this stuff myself. I don't want to get arrested, but other people do. Okay, shedding the clothes, punishments, nakedness, association of homosexuality with demonic possession. This has been a big topic in Renaissance research, which I'm not sure about myself, but. But you know, the notion that men behave like women and women behave like men is very, very powerful, actually, and quite useful. Right? Greenblatt's essay on Twelfth Night is really quite good on that stuff. Anyway, you get the idea. I've sort of gotten my. All right. So, what's historicism? I'm not sure this is the... I always have trouble with this. But you see, it's pretty much... This is, you know, the essay we read, where you start with a historical anecdote and you establish connections with some features of the literary work, right? And so we've been through that, and that's pretty good historicism. In the older sense of historicism is really a notion of asking the question... whether people change over time, okay, whether like the human heart is the same today as it was in ancient Greece, and the problem's really the same, and there's either you believe it or you don't, but that's sort of the old historicism. You know, if you really have to locate the literature in the time in which it was written in order to truly understand it, I take it that would be a form of historicism that you have to. Put it there, but the new critical argument was the heck with the history. Let's just pull it out and see what's useful. And I think you can make a case both ways. I mean, because for one thing, you can't ever know the past.
Right.
You think you know Renaissance England, you think you know ancient Greece, and can place the Bacchae in the context of women's problems. But give me a break. You don't even know what happened yesterday, right? Or across the street. Right, so it's an illusion. Yet it's a very powerful one, and that's got, of course, all the prestige goes with a historical type analysis. You just want to be careful what you're doing, you know, and stay a little balanced. I think any of these things are interesting if you have enough perspective to have some balance. There's two sides to every argument, and if you want to do one of these approaches, just remember that, and it becomes very interesting and very thoughtful. Right? So let's go on to that. Postcolonial and international studies. Well, this is pretty good for translating. This is kind of complicated thing, I guess. Right? King Lear is the story of a man and his three daughters. This was impossible to conceive in Japan. The daughters could not have any say, come anywhere near the father. They were nothing. So he had to shift it over to two men, one of whom's very womanly in that Japanese sense of powerless, right? But you couldn't even conceive of it. It was just too much. Then that's the case where the culture very powerfully impinges on what you're able to do. Race relations are another example of this. Nabokov talks about this. You want to write a story, he said, I'm waiting for the novel about, you know, the mixed race marriage where they're perfectly happy and have dozens of children and grandchildren. And in America in the 50s, you couldn't write that story. Okay, now times are changing, right? But at the time, it was impossible to imagine, right? But because the culture is so constricted, the imagination, and the real artist is trying to break out of that stuff, right? Anyway, so Kurosawa really was a great artist. He would have put those three daughters in there, but he didn't do it. All right, so there we are. That's the critical approaches.
What is phenomenology?
You know, I just had a definition of it. It's really the reader's response kind of thing. It's how you...
Reader response.
I read a bunch of phenomenology stuff, and I just...
Is that just how you feel about the culture?
Yeah, I mean, what you know of a thing, it depends on your point of view of it. Okay? It's almost a Kantian idea, right? If I have this table and I'm looking at it from here... Technically speaking, I have a very different conception of it from if I go down here and look up the other way, right? Okay, now in the mind, you know, we have this ability to sort of take the two views and mix them together so you realize you're looking at the same thing in different directions. But phenomenology is sort of problematizing that mixture. It's almost like a Rashomon thing. That's the easiest way, I think, to understand it. It's never... Rashomon is the Kurosawa movie about a rape that happens in the woods, and then the story is told of what happened by four different people who were involved in it, and each story is completely different. The rapist, his story is he's a great guy, you know, and the woman's got a story, and the passing peddler's got another completely different version. So it all depends. The same event is completely different depending on how you look at it. All right.
Why would you apply that to like King Lear?
Well, that's a good question. But since I don't have a slide of it. But I can, you know, different points of view. A better example might be Hamlet. Was Hamlet mad or not? Mm. Well, everybody sees basically the same behavior, but according to Polonius, Hamlet is mad because he's in love with Ophelia and he's not allowed to see her. That's clearly the cause. The king, he sees Hamlet behaving madly, but he doesn't go for the love theory. He thinks Hamlet is plotting something because he's feeling guilty. Hamlet's mother hardly knows what to think. She doesn't attribute it to love. She doesn't attribute it to deviousness. She just thinks the kid's in mourning for his father and that she'd remarried very quickly.
And Horatio has his own...
And Horatio thinks, this is a hell of a nice guy, you know? Right? Yeah, Horatio has no idea what's going on around him, right? And even Hamlet has his own view of himself, so he changes.
How would a critic use that?
How would a critic? You'd have to get a phenomenology text, you see. You'd have to get phenomenology is a branch of philosophy. So you have to go see what the phenomenologist philosophers are writing Okay, and that will give you, and that you'll find, say, four or five principles of phenomenology, which are good in, over there in the philosophy department, and you bring them in to the English department or the literature department, and you apply them to any text you want. This allows you to do the same analysis on different texts, either even in this, in the same country or around the world. So it's very good for comparative literature, because otherwise we have a lot of trouble finding common things to think about. And this allows us to, it gives you a frame and gives you a certain prestige, okay, so that you can look academic. And you are academic, all right? Because you're actually thinking about something. And you're, but you just have to realize what you're doing. You can't do everything. I can't do the 12 approaches. Actually, I could. If I took one work, I could do 12 approaches to it. But if I got 12 works, I better stick with one approach. Because in 200 pages, I can't do 12 approaches to 12 works. I just had a dissertation last night that was doing that. And he's going to be revising it for the next 3 months. So you don't want to be doing that. Okay? You know, the nature of the beast of the study, you have to limit yourself. Okay? But there's lots of, you know, but you want to keep these things in mind. That's why it's interesting. You're sorry I didn't do that this semester, but I really think that these things for literature come out of the literary text. And if you start thinking about the literary text, you'll...
What was that one?
Oh, did I skip one?
That's okay.
Critical approaches, the counter-arguments. So much of it has been sort of, you know, this is what everybody does, but you can step outside of it, right? You're reading literature to go, you know, it's like first lines. I want to go around the world and see different people, and I want to know a few Chinese characters, you know, and stuff like that. I want to be ready. And if all I know is this one little critical approach, I think I'm very limited. So we're stuck professionally with that critical approach, but let's not, you know, when we get into the classrooms, particularly in undergraduate class, you can have much more fun.
Right.
And if you start doing, you know, we get a job candidate who comes in here and says, I'm going to do this particular approach, and every course the person dreams up is the same damn critical approach. The students get a little tired of that. they want to read the works, you know, on their own, and the formal approach is really also allow you to do that, okay? So, conclusion. Those, you know, like the Bach guy, was good, Oedipus Rex. I mean, for 2,000 years people say it's good, and we're not all so smart, right? We have to pay attention. And even in the critical approaches, I mean, I'm no expert. I found this very useful, and I learned a lot by going through the book. Okay. Any approach or combination of approaches that seems right to you will be right to others if you can express yourself clearly. So you could do a feminist structuralist approach, right? Or a formalist gender approach or whatever. You can come up with your own mixture, right? All right, so that's that.
Can you go back to the third to last slide?
I don't know. Hang on. Oh, I see. I'm not in the slideshow mode.
Yeah, that one. Yeah, I wanted to.
Okay. Yeah. Let's. This is good. The approach I've sort of been doing this semester, it's got a real counter argument to it. Okay. In other words, I think you should read a bunch of books and really get into them. But you should just think about the background. This is the Harold Bloom approach. Okay? Gotta have that story of old Lou, gotta have Oedipus Rex, gotta have Julius Caesar, gotta read these things. Gotta. You know, 10,000 books later, where do you stop? Right? Well, Harold Bloom doesn't stop. He thinks you keep going. Okay? Logically, it just doesn't work. No one person can do all that. So we have to have these critical approaches. Because you're going to write a 200-page dissertation. You're going to get as much as you can in the time that you have. But you have to have some limits.
Critical approaches wouldn't stop you from reading all those works, though.
Yeah, but...
Calling yourself like a Renaissance scholar wouldn't stop you from reading.
There's a balance. You want a certain width, you know, but you want a certain depth of thought. Let's put it that way. You have to find the balance. Right? And, you know, these things change. But Bloom is this constant, you know, he reads the thousands of books. And it was really Greenblatt's experience with Bloom as an undergraduate. He said, stop. Okay. I think a little theory would help. See, you know, not that I'm against the reading, okay, but, you know, I think Shakespeare's better and these Greek tragedies are right up there. And we pick out the good stuff, you know, and maybe James Elroy's right there too. Okay. And if you're going to read weak works, why stop with fiction? You know, why not just go right into historical and other documents and open it up that way? Right. It's more manageable to talk about power than it is to just keep reading and reading, right? And well, he doesn't like that. He calls it the school of resentment. People don't want to read books, right? And a lot of people don't want to read books, but the boy, they'll look at hundreds of movies. Okay, and what I want you to get out of the Elder Olson thing, movies are poems. I mean, you know, they're poetry, they're structured plots and everything else. And you know, people's appetite's pretty huge.
It's a little bit more passive consumption, though.
Right.
You just sit there and it happens and you watch it.
Right, to a certain extent. But, right. Okay, so what's this?
Great literature is about reading.
Ah, yeah, we talked about that, right? That was our first. So here's a little summary of the semester. Okay. Great literature is about rereading, not life. I think you got to keep that in mind. You definitely learn stuff reading, but professionally, okay, these are objects that you know something about and can talk about, and some of them are really well done, right? But I don't read Shakespeare to learn, you know, how I should educate my daughter or not educate her, or how women should behave. I mean, it was another world. Who needs it, right? They get it. They were mean, right? They despised women, right? I don't need to be told that. You know, I don't go to Shakespeare to learn about that stuff. But there's a few other things going on in there, okay? You know, like power, actually, whether you're male or female. He teaches you that, okay? This is an interesting point. Good research tool is, the key research tool is a good dictionary. That you need a dictionary more than you need critical approaches, just understanding the language. Okay, as long as you don't go too overboard. I think that's what Olson's thing about, you know, the unabsorbed resort to the dictionary for meanings that can't possibly be in the text or that are irrelevant. That's what he's talking about. New criticism was known for what's called close reading. You'll hear people talk about that. I have a text, I'll do a close reading of it. What?
Nothing. Just thinking out loud.
Oh, okay. Close reading. And that's kind of what we do. Right? That's still in the back of people's minds with the people who are into literature.
It's a
dwindling thing. It's not the video game world. But
you're not supposed to do that anymore. I can't reconcile that.
Right. Well, we do it. Don't worry about it. Okay. Let me just say, it works really well when you're writing a dissertation. I can get you a job in this biz. Okay. And it's hard. Nothing wrong with close reading. A little theory on top, but keep the close reading in mind. I mean, power is power. And you know, it wasn't because Greenblatt knew about power. He is an exquisite close reader of Shakespeare. Right. God, you know, everybody read those plays, and he sees. He'll say something like, don't you see that Prince Hal is sort of tricking Francis in the tavern? And John goes, no, we never noticed that. He's tricking him? I mean, that's just like really fundamental, right? But, you know, he brought it out. So close reading is good. Okay. The final cause. All right, I'm going to talk about the causes of literature. All right. So let's go back up there and we'll do the 15-minute Ibsen and get out of here. I think that's...
Definitely put that up.
Yeah, I'll put it up for you.
professor do that for a long time.
Oh, that little overview? You never know.
Where do you locate yourself in the theoretical spectrum?
You know, if you'd asked me before I did it, I say I like to take one work and use all the approaches.
Like, what is custom of the castle?
I like to use all the approaches.
It's all in there?
What's custom of the castle? Yeah, no, I mean, that's really kind of old-fashioned. There's a repeated motif, okay? And what does it tell us? How does it set up similarities and differences? It seemed to be doing the same thing in each romance. But what was that thing? And then I had to do the counter argument. Was it doing something different in each romance?
So, consider new criticism?
Well, it allows you close reading.
I've been told a lot of times that my writing sounds old fashioned and like new criticism. But new criticism is like, everybody hates it.
Yeah, well, I'm just telling you, then you do it and you don't call it that.
Right.
And then the morons who say everything's got to be theory, you know, yeah. They'll tolerate you. In fact, the basis of any literary analysis has got to be the close reading.
That's what I think.
And some modesty about the...
Yeah, in Las Vegas.
Modesty about your critical approaches. And I think, you know, there's nothing worse than a fanatic on critical approaches.
I agree with that.
Right. You know, it's like, it's so narrow. And, you know, gosh. I mean, you need to, I don't care what you do, you should read a little Freud and stuff, but we have this semester, next semester you can do more of this. All right, let's take a look at the Ibsen and just... Okay.
Actually,
I feel like that. Do you have it? So, page 146 is a good place to start. Let me